This is Paul Cantabini announcing Pro Lacrosse Talk.
Right off the bat, there's Lyle Thompson. Courier,
Kylie Ohlmiller showing off those shifty skills.
Driver driving hard down the alley, and he scores.
What a goal from Josh Byrne.
Kayla Trainer
flips and scores.
You're kidding me.
By Dylan Ward.
Gets topside. Rambo scores.
Welcome to Pro Lacrosse Talk, your go-to podcast for interviews with professional players, coaches, and executives, as well as the latest news and analysis from all three professional lacrosse leagues. Now, here's your host, Hutton Jackson.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
What's up, Pro Lacrosse fans? Welcome to another edition of Pro Lacrosse Talk presented by Fanatics. Reminder to visit prolacrossetalk.com/NLL shop or prolacrossetalk.com/NLL shop-CA for your official NLL team gear. I'm your host, Hunt Jackson, here joined by PLT contributor Brian Andrews. And today we have a Hall of Fame edition, including an interview with a Hall of Famer and former member of the Philadelphia Barrage and Wings. Brian, I know you're a big Barrage fan, former Barrage fan, as well as a Wings fan. But how are you doing today?
I'm doing great, man. Lots of lacrosse to talk about. I'm really excited to get into it.
Yeah, you're doing double duty this week. You are on the Bet on Lacrosse podcast, and you're on Pro Lacrosse Talk as well. But yeah, I mentioned the Pro Lacrosse Hall of Fame that the Premier Lacrosse put together. 11 inductees in this inaugural class. Not too many surprises, really. You know, maybe a few that we didn't expect, but I think they did a really good job of paying homage to the legends of the game that came, you know, prior, especially in the early days of the MLL. But at attack, you had Casey Powell, John Grant Jr., who we weren't sure if John Grant Jr. was going to be eligible because, you know, the 3-year minimum retirement, but they actually said it was cumulative since he was retired for 2 years, came back, and then was retired for another year. So you have Casey Powell, John Grant Jr., Mark Millen, Gary Gate, Matt Strebel, J.J. Albert, John Gagliardi, Pat McCabe, Nikki Polanco, Brian Docherty, and Paul Cantabini, who is actually our interview today as well. So you'll hear from him directly. But those are your inductees in the inaugural Professional Lacrosse Hall of Fame. Brian, we're not going to go too in-depth into all of these, but I know there's a few that we're pretty certain we're going to be in the Hall of Fame. You know, I mentioned Casey Powell. I think he was a lock to get in. Gary Gate was a lock to get in. John Grant Jr., knowing, you know, he was eligible, he was a lock to get in. But I think in particular, the crazy thing about Gate and Casey is that, you know, Casey had a lengthy career in the MLL. Gary Gate did not necessarily, but both these guys won MVP awards at 38 years old. Casey winning his MVP in 2014 with the launch. Just absurd, the talent level of these guys. You know, I think some people would say they could still probably strap up today and drop a few G's in the professional leagues. They're that good. But no surprises really there. And the same with John Grant Jr., you know, sitting right now top leader in goals in professional field lacrosse history, as well as right behind Paul Rabel and most points in professional field lacrosse history as well. And he's up there pretty high too in the NLL as well. Him and Casey Powell both got inducted in the NLL Hall of Fame this past summer as well. But thoughts on these guys? You know, some of these guys are Barrage guys. Any in particular that stood out to you that you want to, you know, just talk about their legacy?
I love the Barrage love. I grew up watching those guys. They were very prominent in the Philly lacrosse scene. I went to plenty of camps where they were out giving us instructions, and it was fun to watch them win so many championships. They were one of the early lacrosse dynasties. So seeing guys like Strebel and Doc on there, you know, obvious picks, whether or not you wanted them in the first class, I don't think it really matters that much. Particularly Doc, I saw people upset about, you know, maybe Cotrano deserving because he was earlier or something. He's going to get in. It doesn't matter. I'm happy that Doc's getting the recognition he deserves.
No, absolutely. And I agree with you too. Like I tend to have thought that Cotrano was going to be the first goalie inducted, but at the end of the day, we're talking about Hall of Famers getting in first. Like, you know, they're both Hall of Famers. Like, who's going to get in first? It really doesn't matter at the end of the day, you know, who gets in first. And obviously Doc had a phenomenal career winning those two championships with the Barrage, you know, over 1,000 saves. You know, during his career. So yeah, I think Cotrano is a lock for next year. I thought he was a lock for this year. So he's one of the guys we'll talk a little bit about later, you know, who could be in next year's class, but, well-deserved by a lot of these guys. And Strebel too, you know, a prolific career. He played pro soccer for a couple seasons while playing pro lacrosse as well, which is kind of crazy to think about. Right now, he sits fourth in most career games with 171, fourth behind Brody Merrill, Kyle Sweeney, and Brian Spallina. All Hall of Famers in their own right as well. You know, Brody Merrill has to wait a few years once he retires. But, you know, we both think Sweeney and Spallina might get in next year. But talk a little bit about another guy that used to play a lot with Spallina and Polanco. You know, what are your thoughts on Nicky Polanco getting the nod this year?
Just a great pick. And he was so influential for so many of our playing styles at the time, especially because he was very prominent as I was getting into high school. So a lot of coaches and, you know, club coaches would tell you to go watch film of that guy. So absolutely well-deserved and happy to see him get in.
Yeah, no. And, you know, prolific career with multiple teams. Another guy too, like you mentioned, watching Polanco and learning from him, Mark Millen was a guy I watched, you know, his offensive wizardry videos. I think you'd be hard to pressed to find an offensive player that didn't watch those, you know, around my time. And he really did what Rabel, I think, did for lacrosse, you know, with his YouTube presence, before there was YouTube. You know, Mark Millen, and you know, credit to JJ Albert, who was behind the camera for a lot of this stuff, that a lot of these, you know, productions and these videos that were produced, those two really helped bring education to the masses. And it wasn't just, you know, if you went to a Millen lacrosse camp, that was great. But, you know, if you were someone like me that maybe didn't have the chance to go to one of those camps, you could watch the videos and learn from these greats early on, you know, in the age of the VHS and DVDs. So, you know, dating myself a little bit, but it was really, they were really influential beyond just playing on the field. But another guy that's well-deserved, Paul Cantabini, who you'll get to hear from a little bit later, really paving the way for that face-off position. But at the end of the day, yeah, there's a few guys that, you know, maybe we thought might get in and they didn't yet. And they're still Hall of Famers in their own right. And we'll just have to wait a little bit, you know, to see them get in next year. But going off of that, you know, Greg Cotrano has won 5 straight MLL championship appearances. 1-2 of those was the first goalie to win MVP and the only one until Blaze Reardon did it last year. So he's a guy that I think should get in next year for sure. And then Ryan Bull is a guy that I think could have been on the bubble as well. He still leads the in most career assists with 292 and only played 11 seasons. The guys, you know, right underneath of him were Walters, Casey Powell, Paul Rabel, John Grant Jr., Rob Pinnell. All those guys, with the exception of Rob Pinnell, played more seasons than Ryan Boyle, and Ryan Boyle still has more assists than them. So he's a guy that I think is a shoo-in for next year. Any guys that are on your radar to get into the Hall of Fame next year?
I mean, I feel like, you know, Ryan Powell has to be, you know, up there in consideration. And then you mentioned Spallina and Sweeney, also barrage guys. So clearly I just want the entire dynasty checked off the list, but they were also both very super influential in the way that I learned the game and that I played. So I think that they deserve a next nod.
Yeah, absolutely. Spallina with the most championships of any pro field lacrosse player. And then you got Kyle Sweeney sitting 8th in ground balls. Unfortunately, the league didn't really track cause turnovers too well early in the early years. So we don't really have that legacy data, unfortunately. But credit to the PLL stats team, Jake Watts, for putting all this together too on the PLL website. So you guys can actually check out the career leaders and kind of see who moves up the rankings. A guy who hasn't retired yet, but I'm keeping my eye on is Joe Walters, you know, currently sitting at 3 in points. I don't think he'll catch John Grant Jr. and Paul Rabel, but he's high up there on the list as well as, you know, like I said, 2nd in assists. He's a guy that I think is going to get in once he's eligible, you know, first ballot. So hopefully we get a little bit more of him than we did last year, but it's another guy that's kind of under the radar for how good he's been for so long. Granted, he's played 16 seasons, so he's played a long time, but another guy definitely to watch out. And we recently had a retirement of Drew Snyder, you know, who was 4-time champion, 3 times with the Outlaws, 1 with the Whipsnakes. He retired with 199 career goals, which is 22nd all time, including that game-winning goal in the 2014 MLL Championship. And really, if you look 3 years ahead, it's probably going to be him, Paul Rabel, and Kyle Harrison as the midfielders getting into that class. Granted, you know, they might change the rules up and it might not just be 3 per position, you know, with the midfield, but those are 3 guys that I think are going to be first ballot Hall of Famers as well. But As I mentioned, we did have an interview with the Hall of Famer and Paul Cantabini, the head coach of Stevenson as well. So let's toss our interview with him. Today on Pro Lacrosse Talk, I'm lucky to be joined by Paul Cantabini, former pro lacrosse player, head coach at Stevenson University, and member of the inaugural class of the Professional Lacrosse Hall of Fame. Paul, thanks for joining me today.
Oh, thanks for having me. Really looking forward to it. Appreciate it.
Of course. Let's start with that induction into the Professional Lacrosse Hall of Fame. You're a part of this inaugural class. Describe the feeling of having your Major League Lacrosse accomplishments recognized by the PLL.
Well, you know, first of all, just like to really like to thank the PLL and the Hall of Fame committee. It's just really a tremendous honor to be inducted with those other 10 guys. You know, those are the legends of the game, and to be able to be included with them over 20 years of outdoor lacrosse in that first class, it really is something special, not only for me, but for my family and my kids, you know, to see that. And so just very honored to do it. You know, I was very fortunate to play with some of those guys to help me look better than I probably was. And but it was great. I was just very lucky to play with some of the guys that I played with over my career. And just to have the support we did from the Bayhawks during that time, and be able to finish out the barrage was awesome. The end of my career in the outdoor league. So just very, very fortunate, and I can't wait for the induction. So it's going to be a lot of fun.
No, absolutely. And we're going to get into more of your pro career, but prior to playing pro, you played 4 years at Loyola. Talk about when you first started playing lacrosse and then what eventually led you to Loyola.
Yeah. So, you know, my brother, Chris, the way I started playing lacrosse is that, you know, I was really like football and basketball and all that good stuff. And I didn't really play lacrosse until my brother, Chris, who went to Syracuse, brought me home a lacrosse stick. It was a red Magnum with a red head and a silver shaft and brown leathers, which it was awesome. And that's when leather sticks were the thing. And so that's kind of how it took off. And then, you know, when my dad passed, we moved from Fairport, New York to Irondequoit, New York. And a lot of the friends I had at that time were playing lacrosse. And so in middle school, I played for the North team. And a couple of my buddies played for that, and Andy Greaves and Kyle McClements and Rick Harima. And a lot of those guys played. So I played. I didn't really know what I was doing. And so I just kind of was fast and just kind of ran around, and we had a lot of fun. And it's kind of funny how it led to facing off a little bit, because we were playing the North team, and they had this really big guy facing off for them, and nobody wanted to go against him. Excuse me. And so I was like, I'll go against him. And just went out there and won a few face-offs, and then it went from there. But I didn't even play lacrosse until I was in eighth grade. And so that really shows you, like, nowadays kids are playing, by the time they get to eighth grade, they got like 10 years under their belt. You know, that's when I first started. But that's kind of how we led. And then from that, I was lucky enough to be on the JV team my freshman year. And then I got called up at the end of the year, which was really cool, because then I was playing in a playoff game versus Canandaigua. And Canandaigua at that time had with these great players, and Jock Monty was on that, or Fairport, I'm sorry, Jock Monty was on that team, and Tim Sudan, and we're playing them in the semifinals, I guess, the Section 5, and I was a freshman, I got called up, I didn't know what was going on, and so all of a sudden, they're like, Canabine, get in, and I'm like, I'm on the bench, looking there with my other freshman, and so there I am, you know, playing in the Section 5 semifinal game as my freshman year, and I'm going up against All-American Jock Monty, somehow, who's an unbelievable face-off guy. I believe he went to Hobart, and I got beat as quick as you can say. You blow the whistle, he beat me, went down, I think they scored a goal. But I got lucky enough that he took a chance on me to go back out there, and then I ended up winning 5-9 that night, and I scored a goal off a face-off, ran down, and I think we lost 9-7 or 10-8 in that game, but it was a great experience for me to get into that. And then after that, I was lucky enough to be on varsity the next year and made All-County, and then the following year I got better, made All-County, and then I went to a camp that summer called, the first year they had it was Top 205. And six guys from my school were lucky enough to be selected to go for it. So that's the only year Top 205, the recruiting camp, was 205 kids. After that, it was like 628. You know, everybody went to it. And so we're lucky enough to go to that, and I played very well. You know, I was lucky enough, they had a draft then, and I was lucky enough to be the first draft pick in that. Billy the Bajornis, who has passed, a great guy, drafted me, and I was on his team, and we won the championship and everything, and I got seen by Loyola there, and lucky enough, it all took from there. But my mom, the funniest part was, is that, you know, my mom was just a poor sentimentalist. My dad died, you know, I had six brothers and sisters, seven altogether, and you know, and he died of, the family kind of broke up during that point, 81, 82, and they all went on their way to do that. So my mom, you know, it was just me and my younger brother Rob there, and she was a system analyst. And so she didn't have a lot of money to send me to these schools at that time. And so she gave me a great deal. She goes, Paul, you can go to any school in the country you want. And I was like, Mom, that's awesome. I really appreciate that. But you got to get a full scholarship. And so I was very motivated because she didn't have any money to send me to college, where I was going to Monroe Community College. And so I was a very motivated guy that summer, and I was able to go to that camp and play really well. And I was able to get myself one of the last full rides to go to Loyola College. And I think that was the best decision I ever made, really. You know, I wanted to go to Syracuse really bad. They wanted me to go. I took several recruiting trips to Syracuse. I wanted to go there as well. But, you know, I just thought at that time, a big school like Syracuse with 25,000 people at that time wasn't a great fit for me. And I needed a smaller school that looked after me. And Loyola was a small Jesuit school that had small classes and really did a great job with kids. And to go there and Coach Cottle to take the chance on me really worked out, and worked out well for me. And I was lucky enough to get an offer to go there. So I'm really happy about the decision to go there. And Loyola was a great school, and very happy that. But, you know, college at that time was only 16.5, you know, and to go there now, Loyola is like 67. So it's a little different, but it was great.
Yeah, and talk about your time with the Greyhounds and your career there. You guys made some NCAA appearances. So talk about your time with the Greyhounds.
Yeah, I was lucky enough to start on the first midfield line my freshman year. And, you know, what a lot of people don't know about me is that, you know, they just kind of, especially nowadays, people think I was just a face-off guy. But I played in the field, and I ran in the first midfield line. It was me to start out, and a guy named Gene Ubriaco. And Brian Kronberger was our first midfield line until, unfortunately, Gene blew out his knee in a scrimmage against Maryland. And then Teddy Nichols was at the first line. We ran all year with them and had a great freshman year, and had some big games. I think my best game was against Virginia that year, where I had 3 goals as a freshman. And then, I had a good career. I didn't face off a lot at Loyola until about my senior year. We had some other guys that were pretty good. And, you know, and so I my senior year, I was able to ran the whole first midfield line all year. Me, Kevin Anderson, and Dan Burnham were the first midfield line. I faced off all year and did that. And I was lucky enough to make a second team All-American. But, you know, my freshman year, we went to the national championship game. We lost to Syracuse 18-9. So that was a pretty good team. That 90 Syracuse team was pretty good. And they got it, but we made the playoffs each and every other year. And then my senior year, we lost in the quarterfinals to Princeton, who I think ended up winning the national championship. But it was a great experience. And I think Loyola did a lot to really develop me and who I am today, and all the things they did off the field to help me really helped. Cause, you know, it was tough for my mom being a single mom, you know, raising me and my brother and trying to do all that at the same time. And so they really did a great job.
Yeah, no, and your first professional foray wasn't actually in the field game. It was in the indoor game, which was very different back then with major indoor league lacrosse, which eventually became the NLL. You had 11 seasons in that league. Talk about your first foray into professional lacrosse in a style of lacrosse that was different than what you had played prior.
Well, you know, playing in the NLL was just so much different than the field game. And I really enjoyed playing the NLL because it was just, I thought the field game and the NLL were just two different games. All together. And the NLL really kind of played into my physicality and what I wanted to do. And I was able to play two hands, which is another thing people really don't know, is that in the NLL a lot, I played left-handed. I was a right-handed player, but I played left-handed and be able to play me more. And so I was lucky to get on that team. I think Judge Russell drafted me in the second round to be on that team, and it was great. And my first year, I had a lot of success. You know, I was the MVP of the team and was able to go out there and do a lot of really good things. And it was really interesting to play because the NLL back then was really very physical. The rules were much different. It was really a physical game. You pretty much had to assault somebody to get a penalty. So, you know, but you got to play in a lot of great buildings and against a lot of great players. You know, I remember playing against John Tavares and Beltman and all those guys during that time. So playing for Baltimore and doing all that was a lot of fun. I really enjoyed that. And my time in the NLL was awesome. I really enjoyed every year of it and had a lot of fun.
Yeah. And what do you think of, you know, more Americans now playing in the NLL and particularly a lot of the faceoff specialists in the field game now going over and kind of developing their skills more as a complete lacrosse player in the box game?
I mean, I think playing box only helps you playing in those small conditions, the small areas, the physicality of it, being able to handle the physicality of it, being able to score tough goals, the different mindset, how creative you have to be in order to score. You just can't shoot at a million miles an hour and hope it goes in. You know, the goalies are really good. And you have to be able to do a lot of things. You got to understand concepts. You got to understand how to play off the ball. You can't even, a lot of the ball dominant guys in college go to the NLL and struggle a little bit because they're so used to having the ball. And that's not what it's about. It's about moving the ball, getting to open spots and doing that. And so I think it only enhances the abilities of the field guys to go and play box. And I really enjoyed my 11 years playing with all the teams I did. in the NLL and all the success we had doing that. And I think some of the best fans are in the NLL, man. If you look at Philly, I remember, you know, going to Philly, getting, you know, I was able to play against Philly and hear them tell me how much I sucked, you know, every introduction. It was awesome, you know, to tell that. But then I was also able to end my career in Philly. And, you know, I had a, you know, to get the other way and how much they really appreciate great play. I scored 5 goals against Colorado 1 year, one of my last games there, and, you know, be able to, you know, run around the field and have them give you a standing O is unbelievable. So, you know, the fans in the NLL, I think, are incredible and how they support their teams and everything. So that's really one of the best parts of the league to do that. And plus playing in all the buildings I was able to play in. You know, I got to play in the old Odd, got to play in Maple Leaf Garden, got to play in Joe Louis Stadium, Joe Louis out in Detroit, all those great, got, you know, out in Nassau Coliseum, got to play in the Boston Garden. It was awesome. You know, those things are, you know, a lot of field guys don't get to do that, you know, to play in those awesome places. So I thought that was really another great part to do that, to be able to do all those and play in those buildings and all that stuff was awesome.
No, absolutely. And then now Major League Lacrosse began with a showcase eventually, and then a 2001 season. You played for the BayHawks. You won 2 championships with them. Then you ended your career on top with the Philadelphia Barrage, winning another title. Talk about being a part of the early MLL days and, you know, the first kind of foray of professional field lacrosse.
It was great. You know, I mean, it was just good that, man, before that, you know, we played in the USILA, you know, it was just club lacrosse and all those guys. And, you know, that was and that was great. You know, that was pretty much the MLL before it started. You know, they had all those teams, MAB Paints and Capital and the Green Turtle, Mount Washington Lacrosse Club, who I played for, and the Long Island Lacrosse Club. You know, those teams were all just like the MLL teams, but now we were getting paid to play. And so, which makes it really good. And, but it was a little rough at early. I think they were just trying to get by. But, you know, the play in the field was outstanding. You got to remember, it was only 6 teams at that time. And you only dressed 17 guys. And so the battle just to play and practice was insane. And so to get the guys on the field. But, you know, those experiences are great. You know, some of them are a little questionable when you're playing in baseball fields and parks and all that stuff. But they're just trying to get off the ground to do that. But, you know, that our BayHawk team, those early BayHawk teams we played with were incredible. You know, this, the talent from the D to the offensive end was great. And, you know, playing Long Island in that first championship game was awesome, even though we lost it. It was a great game, you know, but those teams were really outstanding, even compared to today. You know, the PLL has great teams. I mean, if you look at those teams and look at the honors from top to bottom of those teams, the guys that were playing, it was truly remarkable. And a lot of those guys, which people don't realize, they weren't in their 20s. You know, a lot of those guys weren't 23, 24, 25 years old. You know, my first year in the MLL, I was 30, you know, when I did that, you know. So, you know, and I retired when I was 36. So a lot of those guys, like the Gates and all those guys that played in there, they were in their 30s, in late 30s when they retired. So they were playing at a very high level for a very long time, which is a little bit different now when you look at the PLL. All those guys, or a lot of those guys, are in their 20s. And you know, Paul retiring this past year, he was 35, I think. And, and so, you know, they're, you know, it was just a lot different when we were picking up that league as old men, so to speak. And then adding in all the new guys as they came each year. So it was great.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I think Tony Rush was the one that recounted the story of you signing your cleats and leaving them at the midfield to mark your retirement. Talk about that final MLL championship and decision to call it a career after that game.
Well, there's a lot more that went into that, really. So that all plays back into the 2005 national team tryouts for 2006 USA team, USA team. And I was very disappointed not to make the team in 2006. You know, I thought I had a great tryout. And it seemed like I was on the team, and my play in that tryout was actually a lot of things that happened in that tryout that kind of affected the tryout, because even in the bubble game, which they had back then, they had me switch teams at halftime. So I was playing so well at times, I thought, you know, I was winning all the faceoffs in the first half for the one team. Then they go, Paul, you got to go play for the other team. We had the ball too much. Right. So they had to go play for the other team. And a lot of guys were upset about that because that affected how much they had the ball. I mean, it showed what they could do in that bubble game. And then wasn't selected for the team, which I was pretty upset about. So I kind of retired, really. It's like, I'm done with this, and did that. And then the Barrage called me and they're like, hey, do you want to play? You know, and I'm sitting on my couch drinking a beer, like retired. And I'm like, well, sure. And then, so I went back and played, and I think they had a game in a park. We were playing in New Jersey for something, and that was my first game back, so I haven't played for a while. But then also got a phone call from Coach Seaman and Matt Kerwick saying, hey, the team USA might want you to come back. Because, you know, Casey might have a baby, and I think Jabert was hurt, and this kid Schneider on that team is looking pretty good, and they might reconsider the direction they went into, and they need a faceoff guy. So I joined Team USA then as an alternate, went to Ontario and played and all that kind of stuff. And at the end, I wasn't selected for the game and for the team again. And they went with that team, and they lost in the championship game to Team Canada with Jeff Schneider pretty much dominating them with that. So that's kind of a bitter pill to swallow, standing on the sidelines watching Jeff win all those faceoffs when you think you should be out there. But I did the good thing for Team USA because I wanted to support my country and go out there and do that. I thought that was really important to do, and I did that. So then when we came back to the season again, I was a pretty motivated guy. And then knowing that and playing into the playoffs, I was playing some of my best, I was facing off some of the best of my career at that time. And then I was lucky enough, we got to the championship game with the Barrage, and we were lucky enough to face Los Angeles, who had Cersei and Jeff Schneider on the team. So I was really eager for that game and very motivated to play well. And I had a great day and be able to beat Jeff, 11 out of 15 times that day, and beat Chris Cersei, you know, 20 out of 22 times that day, and score a goal and help lead our team to a 10 goal win was awesome. And then, so, but then I knew at 36 years old, and that game was over, that my days were kind of limited. So, you know, at that time, I just, you know, took my cleats off and placed them at the X, a place that treated me so well for, you know, 13 years of my life playing pro lacrosse. And so I just thought that was appropriate to do that and leave my cleats where it all started, and kind of walk off into the sunset and with those guys. And, you know, my last year of the Barrage was awesome with Doc and Strebel and Boyle and Tony Resch, and all those guys were awesome. And that was just a great way to end my career in the pro level.
No, absolutely. A very fitting end to an awesome career. And I want to get your thoughts now on the PLL and kind of what the league is doing to advance the pro game. Obviously, a lot has changed now, but kind of what are your thoughts on the current Premier Lacrosse League?
Well, I think they're doing a great job so far. You know, they're really trying to get people interested and, you know, really highlighting the players, which I think is awesome, and getting them out there. And I think a lot of young kids really like it. And the social media they're on and everything they do to get the people involved. You know, my son's a huge Atlas fan. You know, he loves going to the games and all that kind of stuff. And so I think they're doing a good job. You know, I think eventually they're going to have to get the city base sometime and get to build that, but they're doing what they have to do right now in order to promote pro lacrosse and the best players in the world out there. And I think they're doing a really good job and doing that. And they're taking their time with it. They're not rushing to do anything. They're trying to really figure out what's the right way to go and to enhance the sport for the better, you know? So since, you know, lacrosse is really more, you know, college central, for the most part, but they're doing a great job raising in the pro level now and making more awareness. I think they're getting great, great numbers and people understanding who these players are for the long term. So younger kids can look up to them and go, hey, I want to be, you know, Josh Byrne, you know, I want to go do that. I want to be these guys. And I think they're doing a really good job promoting it. And, you know, the Hall of Fame now adding into that, you know, that's just an incredible step they took to enhance the game and make people and honor the guys that who've been doing it for so long. Sometimes lacrosse forgets about those guys, I think, sometimes, and to honor those pioneers, the guys that put in so much in the, you know, playing club ball, starting the MLL, playing in the early days of the NLL, doing all that dirty work for these guys to have the things they have today is a great way for them to go about it. So it's really awesome.
No, absolutely. And moving on from your playing career, you're a coach now with Stevenson. You've been their coach since 2005. You guys have gone through some magical tournament runs, and one of them, you know, ended in a 2013 D3 championship. Talk about coaching the Mustangs and what it's like, you know, been coaching all these years.
Yeah, it's been, you know, Stevenson's done so much for me and my 18 years, going into my 18th year here now. So it's been real tremendous. I took a big chance coming back to them back in the day. You know, I was at the University of Maryland to lead the University of Maryland, a big time D1 school with a great program, to go to a little school called Villa Julie College that only had 17 guys on their team. It's kind of a true miracle where we are, but also it's a real appreciation for what Stevenson has invested in men's lacrosse to get us to where we are, to build up to where one of the best programs in the country. You know, we made 12 straight NCAA tournaments. We've had about 100 All-Americans and 150, you know, all conference guys. And, you know, that's just truly a testament to what they've been doing to support us and the guys that believe in us, you know, all the players that we've had that believed in us to get us to where we are today is truly thankful for them. And it all accumulated with that 2013 win, you know what I mean? Winning the national championship in Philadelphia against RIT, against all the odds. And, you know, that was awesome. And, you know, our goal is to get back there. We're currently trying to do that. But the ride that we've had here has been really, it's truly a miracle. It shouldn't have happened. It's pretty much impossible to happen for a small you know, what's perceived as a girls' Catholic school, the commuter school, to what we are now is great. But I think that says a lot to a lot of the coaches out there. You know, one of the big things I had when I was going to take this job, Coach Seaman says, you should take this job. You should go look at it. And I go, well, I like being in D1. He's like, Paul, you can always go back. You know, don't turn down something you have in hand. So I took a chance on it. And a lot of people today is like, well, that's D3. They just don't know, you know, what these guys go through. All our guys go through everything those D1 guys do. They put in the time, the effort, the weights, the film, the practice time, you know, and a lot of you see right now, a lot of great D3 guys are in Division 1. You can see Jacksonville has a great guy from Tufts doing that. You know, Franklin and Marshall got their best player who's starting for Villanova. You know, a lot of these guys are doing that. Ohio State has a defenseman from Lynchburg playing a ton. You know, there's a lot of these D3 guys now that are playing in the Division 1 ranks, and they're players. And I think people are really starting to understand this, the quality level of D3. And I've really become, over my time, a D3 supporter. You know, I think I just love the family aspect of it. You know, what you have to do to build a program, not everything's giving to you, everything's earned. And I think that's really a great part of it, that teaching your players how to earn things, not be given things, and that it helps them for the rest of their lives. So I'm really thankful for everything Stevenson's done for me over my 18 years.
No, absolutely. I'm a former D3 player myself, didn't play much, but at DeSales, so a fellow Mac member.
I love it. All right, yeah. I love it.
Yeah, so definitely D3 supporter as well. And talk about this current team. You guys just came off a 17-9 win versus your Sinus. You know, looking to, like you said, make an NCAA tournament run this year as well. How's the team feel so far? What's the vibe like?
Well, I think we're really happy to get, you know, victory number one. You know, I think, and we're lucky enough to have some people back from last year. You know, Mark Powell, who we think is one of the best goalies in the country, returned this year to help us. So that helps. And Matt Wilson, one of our starting defensemen, came back. But I think we're, you know, more of a team than we ever been. You know, we're the sum of our parts. And I think we did a really good job in offense led by Cam Leidig. We had five goals. And we're asking a lot of guys to do a lot of things. And we're really young. You know, three of our top six middies are freshmen. You know, we got a new faceoff guy who played outstanding in our first game. And so we're happy where we're heading, but you know, we got big games coming up against Colorado College, Gettysburg, and Denison, and you know, Dickinson, and Franklin, and Marshall, and Salisbury. So, you know, there's not a whole lot of time to hang our hat on the first week one victory. We got to get ready for what's coming at us, and we're really excited about it. And we got a lofty goals that we want to achieve, and you know, we got to be able to get better each and every week.
Absolutely. Well, that wraps up kind of our main portion, but I want to do some quick hitters with our 5 and 5. So I'll ask you five lacrosse questions, and then 5 off the field questions. And the first one I like to ask is, what were some of your pregame routines or superstitions when you played?
I always like to get a good pasta meal in me about 4 hours before game time. I always like to go get some baked ziti and meatballs. That's what I always did wherever I went. And when I played in the professional leagues, just to make sure I had some good nutrients in me and ready to go. I always got the baked ziti and meatballs.
Awesome. And number 2, what has been your favorite venue to play pro lacrosse at? And that can be both indoor or outdoor.
I always love playing in Philly. You know, I think playing in the Spectrum, you know, or in the Spectrum, or playing in the First Union Center, or whatever it's called now, you know, it's been great playing there. I remember playing with the Crossfire and playing the Wings there in front of 19-5, been incredible. And I also think, you know, being able, I know it's 2, I gave you only asked for 1, but playing in Maple Leaf Gardens in front of 18,000 people in a playoff game up there was incredible. You know, so those two places were the two favorite kind of places to play in my professional career. Those two places were awesome.
Awesome. Number 3, what's been your favorite team to be a part of during your career? And you can pick a couple, because I know it's probably hard to pick one, but.
I think my playing career.
Yes.
I think my playing career would probably be just that Barrage team I ended my career with. You know, just, I know it was only 6 games, but the circumstances that led into it and everything that led into me ending my career there and everything, it's pretty special for me. And those guys embraced me, even though I only played 6 games with them. Really embraced me as a great way to end my career. And I think secondly, they had another one. I just think, you know, that BayHawk championship team we had was incredible, you know, with Gary and Mikey and Maricek at attack and, you know, just having all those middies and being able to finish the career getting coached by, you know, Gary was the head coach, but having Dave Huntley on the sideline, you know, who's not with us anymore, was incredible. So, you know, that was just an incredible run, and winning that championship up there in Boston was awesome.
Great. And then number 4, who's been your toughest player to face during your career?
My toughest guy I ever faced is, we all created, I just thought it was Mark Gowers, the face off. Mark Gowers was a bear to play against. He was a big human being. He was so good and so tough. So I always say Mark was the toughest guy I've ever played. If he played longer and in the pros and stuff, Mark, you might be talking to about Mark being in the PLL Hall of Fame and not me, because, you know, Mark was that tough to go against.
Awesome. And then final lacrosse one, which current pro lacrosse player do you enjoy watching right now?
Oh, I love watching Blaze Rudin. You know, I think the guy, you know, I know he's a fellow Rochesterian, which is awesome. But, you know, he just plays so hard all the time. He makes a difference in the game in so many different areas. You know, he's playing short stick indoor. He's playing, you know, goalie outdoor. So I love watching Blaze play, you know, and I think secondly, the person I'll give you a second is that I just love watching Josh Byrne play. You know, I coached him 1 year in the MLL when I was coaching in there. And I love watching. He's just so creative. I just love how he plays.
Yeah, both chaos guys, fun to watch. And in the indoor game, you know, with Buffalo and Philly as well.
Well, you know, he's a lot like me. I like his intensity. So me and Andy are, you know, we're one in the same a little bit in that aspect.
Absolutely. Next set of questions is off the field. So this is still sports related, but who's a player in another sport that you enjoy watching right now?
Love watching Josh Allen, my Buffalo Bills, baby. Go Bills, you know, so I'm a huge fan, you know, so go Josh.
Yeah, no, I think the Bills is a fun team to watch. I'm a Ravens fan, so don't like when we face each other. But since they weren't in the playoffs this year, I was really hoping the Bills would get over the hump. I still think they might, you know, in a couple seasons. So hopefully it doesn't come at the mercy of me as a Ravens fan. But
I know all about the Ravens. I hear it every day from all my guys.
I'm sure you do. Number two, what are some hobbies or activities you enjoy doing when you're not coaching lacrosse?
Well, I got two hobbies that I enjoy more than anything. You know, I love playing golf, and I'm an avid golfer, and I love my model trains. I got one of the biggest model train sets in all of Maryland or Pennsylvania. It's huge, you know, 15 different train rails going and 11 8x4 things. I love model trains, and put on a great show every Christmas open house for all the kids to come and watch it. So I'm a huge model train guy.
That's awesome. Wow.
Yeah, cool.
Number three, what is your favorite spot to vacation?
My wife would probably, she said she, I wouldn't know because I don't go on a whole lot of vacations, so I really don't have one spot. You know, we go to Ocean City Beach, Ocean City a lot, and down that way in Fenwick, we do that a lot, but I'm hoping to go on vacation down in South Carolina one time. You know, we love Charleston. We went down there one time. We love that area. So I hope to get back again down there soon.
Great. And then number four, what's your favorite meal? I know you touched on this maybe a little bit earlier, but what's your favorite meal? Do you prefer to dine out or cook at home?
Well, again, if you talk to my wife, I just love staying at home because I'm never at home because I'm coaching and all that all the time. But I love meat. One of my favorite dishes that I think my wife makes is meatloaf and mashed potatoes. I love it. You know what I mean? That's one of my favorite meals to go to that she makes. She makes a great shepherd's pie as well. But I'm a big Italian guy, you know, so I always kind of kid my wife about, you know, meatballs. My mom makes some unbelievable meatballs. So when she makes them, I kind of always tease her a little bit and just go, well, not quite mom, but they do a great job. My wife makes a great meatball. So, you know, that's kind of where I had a few meals that I'm a big fan of, but I like food a little bit too much, I think. So I'm a big fan.
No, nothing wrong with that. And then my final one is, since, you know, quarantine now is obviously over, but we like to ask this question because people binging stuff, whether it's books, TV shows, or podcasts, but anything you're binging right now that you'd recommend?
I'm a big Ozark guy, right? I love the Ozark show. You know what I mean? A big show. I love it. So I can't wait for the next 7 episodes to come out. And so you can watch that. I think that's awesome. Watch from the beginning, though. You haven't watched it, just watch all the seasons, binge watch all that. I'm a big Ozark guy. I think it's an unbelievable show.
Yeah, no, I agree. I'm waiting for those last that last part of the final season.
I also like Westworld. So I had Westworld, another big one I binge watched during COVID. I can't wait till that comes out this summer from HBO. So I'm a big fan of that.
Westworld's another good one. Yeah, those are two of my favorites. So yeah, good ones for sure. And then that wraps up our 5 and 5. But I'd like to end on one final question. That's, what is some advice you have for a young player looking to play lacrosse professionally one day?
Never give up. You know, I think sometimes there's a lot of guys that, you know, well, I'm not good enough to do this, or I'm not good enough to play. I think you just got to get out there and make your own mark. You never give up. And the guys, I think the PLL are looking for guys that are hard-nosed guys that really work hard, that want to be good lacrosse players, right? And if you do that, you're going to be pretty successful. I think, you know, people get too wrapped up in names. You know what I mean? Like, this guy, look at his name. He must be really good. And they don't really look at who are the really good players in lacrosse. The really good players are guys, are tough-nosed guys that want to be good lacrosse players and understand what it takes. Not the guys who are all getting all the stars. You know, the tough-nosed guys are people that when you look out there, you know, that look at that guy working hard. Look at him, you know, like Earnhardt, you know, I know he gets a lot of things, but if you watch him, just look how hard he works on and off the field to be good. And I think that's what players nowadays, if you work hard and on and off the field and follow your dream, it's going to happen. So I like to say all the time that, you know, my whole life's a miracle. You know what I mean? I shouldn't be here. You know, like my dad died when I was young. You know, I didn't even play lacrosse till I was in eighth grade. I don't know how my mom even put up with me. I don't know how I got a full scholarship to Loyola to be able to do that. I don't know how I was able to play in the pros. I got lucky but made the most of my opportunity. So when you get your 5 seconds of fame, make it worth it. All right. Cause you might not get another 5 seconds. And so, you know, that's what I like to say. Everything we've achieved here at Stevenson is a miracle. You know, you can't go to a small girl school with 17 guys and think you're going to win a national championship, become one of the best programs in the country. So work hard. And if you believe a miracle can happen, go make it happen.
No, I love that. Well, thank you so much, Paul, for joining us. Best of luck with Stevenson this upcoming season. And we look forward to that induction ceremony.
Thanks for having me. This was great.
So we're thankful that Paul Cantabini could come join me this week on this episode. Congratulate him again for his induction in the Professional Lacrosse Hall of Fame. Now to the NLL a little bit. We had some big news this week. Commissioner Nick Sakevich has announced that he is stepping down as commissioner. Now, a lot of people saw that as maybe a cause for concern. From what I've heard, it's really not. His contract was up. And with the collective bargaining agreement coming up this summer that the Players Association has not renewed the option for next year. So we will have to have a new collective bargaining agreement this summer. They thought made sense for Commissioner Sakevich to step down since he was planning on doing it and his contract was up now. That way they can work on finding his replacement. Currently, Jessica Berman, the deputy commissioner, is going to fill in his place in the interim. I don't know if that means, you know, she could potentially be the new commissioner. I think that'd be big for the sport if she is, or if she'll stay as deputy commissioner and just kind of fill that role until they find a new commissioner. But I think we have to give a lot of credit to Commissioner Sakevich. When he took over 6 years ago, the league only had 9 teams. And it was very common for these franchises to, you know, come around for a couple of years and then go away or relocate. And we have had some relocations, but the teams have increased from 9 to 15, and, you know, 16 is apparently on its way as well after Las Vegas. And then, you know, they've even talked about expanding as far as 20. So I think that's why I was a little surprised that he's stepping down, because it seemed like, you know, him and the front office had a big plan to continue to expand. But talk a little bit, Brian, on the other side, you know, that's expansion, and we'll talk a little bit more about that. But what are some other things you think Commissioner Sakevich did really, really well for this league?
Well, you also brought up the fact that teams were very transient, would show up every once in a while and then for a couple of years, and then they would go away. And the Wings are a really good example of the team. And I grew up, you know, going to a Wings game or two. Mm-hmm. The indoor game wasn't very popular where I lived. I didn't grow up with it necessarily. And the efforts that he made to establish like TV deals and introduce the sports betting into the NLL world, and also bring outside financial interests like Steve Nash and Wayne Gretzky for the new Las Vegas team. Like all that stuff kind of like wrote me back in. I mean, having the Wings back help, but that also speaks to his ability to financially expand the league to the number of teams that we have now. Without the effort that he didn't put up, I might not be sitting here talking about the NLL right now. I might not be watching like everyone else on ESPN. So couldn't be more grateful, because I'm having a great time growing as a more legitimate fan rather than someone who went to a one-off game every once in a while.
No, I agree. And I think too, just what he was able to do, you know, you look at what the Nighthawks go to Halifax, that's a new market where they're, you know, hungry for pro sports and they don't have pro sports. And what Kurt Stiers has been able to do with Halifax, I mean, they had great attendance numbers. Unfortunately, you know, that was kind of dampened a little bit because of the COVID restrictions, but now they were welcoming fans back and stuff. And by doing that, he still gave Rochester a new franchise too, as well. And, you know, brought back the Wings and stuff, and, you know, going to emerging markets like San Diego and Las Vegas, like markets you would never think would have indoor lacrosse. And I think that's a credit to him and, you know, Joe Tsai as well, who purchased those two franchises I just mentioned. But credit to him to kind of push the boundaries. We now have box lacrosse in Texas, you know, so in Fort Worth. And I think he recognized where there's markets that are hungry for professional sports, and saw that as an opportunity for lacrosse, not necessarily just sticking to the hotbeds, because as we've seen, the hotbeds don't necessarily do, you know, particularly well necessarily. Baltimore had multiple teams that didn't do super well, you know, same with the DC area. And it was really just like Philadelphia was, you know, the prime example of a really big hotbed for college lacrosse and, you know, youth lacrosse that was a perfect pro market. I think that says a lot about Philly fans, as you know, as you would say, whereas other markets, you know, like Boston and Baltimore, you know, even upstate New York had a handful of teams. Now they get Albany, but you know, it was tough for these markets to kind of get people interested in box cross. And I think he's been able to do that in markets that you wouldn't really expect. And then you mentioned the franchise value, you know, both the Rush and it sounds like Las Vegas went for over 10 million when they were sold. Whereas, you know, I think prior to his tenure, franchises were probably still in the six figure range in terms of valuation. Now, of course, there's inflation added into that as well. But I think the value of the franchises have dramatically gone up. And as you add more franchises, more, you know, other people get involved, that's great for the sport.
You know, I think one of the things why the hotbed regions didn't really catch on is because that's a version of the sport that isn't really taught in any of those regions.
Mm-hmm.
We're all taught in that like tri-state area. We're taught the field game. We go through a feeder program to a high school that's going to get us recruited. And then we go to a college to play the field game. People didn't really teach the box game. We just saw pros go into an indoor league or got introduced to Canadians who came down to play in an indoor league. We didn't even necessarily understand that it was Canadian, not origin, but like the, but it was like a very Canadian heavy league.
Mm-hmm.
But now with all of this effort and all of these TV deals and all of this expansion, and whether it's a hotbed area or not, with more people watching it, more people, and you see more coaches too, also emphasizing the skills of the box game and the prominence of the chaos, which is a very box heavy skill set team. I think people are really changing their mind about that. And I think both things are happening right around the same time. The league is going to hit some form of resonance where it's going to exponentially grow in a good way because of all of these combined things. And none of them would be possible if all of what we had just mentioned hadn't happened.
Absolutely. And, you know, I think their partnerships with US Box Law and, you know, these collegiate box lacrosse leagues too, that occur, you know, you're seeing a lot more Americans play box in college and then at the youth level as well. So I think, you know, it's all interconnected and I think it's great for the sport. I think, you know, the league is in good hands. And for people that saw this news, as you know, I was shocked as well, but I don't think it's a cause for concern at all. You know, obviously we do have the upcoming CBA, which will have to be worked out. So, you know, definitely some negotiations that are going to be going on, but I think the state of box lacrosse in the NLL is thriving right now, is going to continue to thrive no matter who becomes commissioner. You know, hopefully it's a guy that can really take what Sakevich was able to do and build upon that. But I think, yeah, I have nothing but good things to say about Commissioner Sakevich, and he was a great interview too, always gave us some time. So appreciate that about him as well. But in terms of on the floor, this season is full speed ahead and, you know, we're about halfway through and some teams are looking great. Some teams are not. You know, COVID is starting to really go down a little bit, which is good. So we're seeing these teams in their true form. So we'll start off with a team that's maybe not looking so hot, and the Firewolves. They lost 15-13 to the Nighthawks last week, lost to the Bandits 13-8, and then lost to the Rock 13-9. So they're on a 3-game losing streak. Not looking too great for this Firewolves team that really seemed like they were turning a corner not too long ago. Kind of thoughts on this Firewolves team and their upcoming schedule, Brian?
It's tough because after the Bedes trade is when they kind of, their stock started rising, their offense was kind of finding a groove, and they just can't seem to really, you know, find the momentum. I mean, aside from, you know, the Nighthawks, the Bandits and the Rock are two really good opponents. So like those losses don't look really bad, but when you couple that with the Nighthawks loss, it can be kind of deflating as we get into the back half of the season where, the strength of schedule for a lot of these East teams is going to skyrocket, and Firewolves is a good example, but I wanted to talk about that in more detail later.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. We'll talk about that a little bit, but yeah, upcoming, you know, they play the Seals, Bandits, Thunderbirds, and then the Swarm are their next 4 games. So, you know, no small task for any of those games. I do think they're alive to win any of those games. You know, the Seals is probably going to be their toughest test going out West, but you know, they could win those games. It's, you know, kind of an any given day type of league, but they're going to have to probably split those games to kind of still keep their playoff hopes alive. You know, going 1-3 in those next 4 is not going to be good for them. And they have a lot of other teams that are, you know, competing for that spot as well. A team that is on the up and up that actually beat the Firewolves is the Rock. They beat the Bandits, handed the Bandits their first loss last week, 12-10. This past weekend, they beat the Firewolves 13-9. They're 5-1 in their last 5, scoring 12 or more in all 5 games. So talk a little bit about this Rock team, what you've seen from them, both on the offensive end, as I mentioned, but also on the defensive side.
They did have some COVID issues, but even in games where they were back and healthy, they were still struggling to put up numbers. Their defense was holding teams pretty good. Nick Rose has been great in cage. They were struggling to get 10 goals a lot of the time, even when they were, you know, at full strength, so to speak. But this streak that they're having is actually pretty fascinating on the offensive and defensive ends. If you graph their scoring over the course of the season, it was pretty stagnant and pretty low, maybe a slight decline, and now it's on a steady incline. Over the last five games, they've scored 12 or more. Only one of them was a loss, and they lost by one or two. But then in the last, four most recent games, the highest amount of goals they let up was 10. So they're keeping a majority of teams under 10 in the most recent history of the game. So my stock in them is rising. I would love to see them go up against the Seals, because I think that's going to be a really, really key matchup, a preview matchup for what might happen very late in the playoffs.
Mm-hmm. No, absolutely. And I think the thing with the Rock, you know, we always know they're a good team. They're good in transition. They're a good, solid defense. I think when they're at full strength, they can beat anybody in this league. The issue, I think, is they rely heavily on their leading scorers, you know, and Rob Hellier, Dan Dawson, Tom Schreiber is playing lights out this season. And, you know, there was a few games where they were missing one or even two of those guys. And I think that's where their depth isn't the same as the Bandits. It's not the same as the Seals. Seals and Bandits have a lot of depth on the offensive end. They could be missing a few guys and they're still going to put up points. Whereas the Rock don't really have as much depth, but they're starting, you know, lineup can hang with anybody. So I think that's what, you know, as long as they stay healthy and they're able to have, you know, all their starters, you know, playing, like I said, I think they can beat anybody, and they're showing that playing, you know, some tough teams. And Hannon Bandits, their first loss, you know, and that's a rivalry that we love to watch. And you know, that was a tough game, and I don't think we take anything away from the Bandits. I just think that shows that the Rock again can compete with anybody in this league. You know, and the Thunderbirds are another team that are right up there that, you know, kind of gave the Rock some troubles, but they handed them their first loss as well. And I think with the Thunderbirds also is another team that has a lot of depth. So the Rock, I think you can put them in that conversation with the Seals, Bandits, and Thunderbirds. The problem is if they're not healthy, then, you know, these other teams can kind of get by, whereas I think the Rock, that's when they start to struggle a little bit. But yeah, I think they're looking great right now. And another team that's looking great despite some injuries, you know, is the Vancouver Warriors. Since Mitch Jones went down, the Warriors are still 3-0 with a 17-11 win versus Panther City, 13-7 win versus Saskatchewan, and an 11-10 win versus Calgary. So not the toughest opponents that they're facing, but still important for them to get those wins in this West. And they're putting themselves in a position to, you know, go on a run where they can make the playoffs, which they haven't done, I think, as a Warriors team. So, you know, you have to go back to their stealth days before they've made the playoffs. And so I think that's, you know, a nice turnaround for this team, despite losing Mitch Jones. Hopefully they can get him back for a playoff run. Still kind of up in the air right now, but thoughts on this Warriors team, you know, getting some wins despite not having Mitch Jones. They didn't have Alex Buque the last game, but they're still putting it together and stringing along a couple of wins here.
I share your concerns about the strength of schedule and, you know, with or without Mitch Jones. I don't like to talk about teams like, oh, they're missing one guy, so like they can't, you know, perform against other teams. It's a team of professional athletes. They all are going to contribute. So Mitch Jones has clearly affected them, but I don't think that Mitch Jones alone is going to tell us whether or not Vancouver is going to end up being a playoff team. Mm-hmm. This next stretch of games is going to tell us whether or not they're going to be able to compete in a playoff scenario or not. They're playing the Thunderbirds, the Rock, the Mammoth. They're playing the playoff gauntlet, the Thunderbirds, the Rock, the Mammoth, and the Seals, like in a row. Mm-hmm. So essentially it's going to show whether or not they're going to be a team that's like worth contention. So they're still a wait and see just because of what their schedule has been for me.
Yeah, I tend to agree as well. That's a tough schedule, and they play the Firewolves after those four games too. You know, another team that's not, you know, an easy out as well. So I think they put themselves in a good position right now in the standings where, you know, if they split these next four games, you know, I think that's a win for them. You know, even better if they go 3-1. I don't see them, you know, winning all four of these games. Whereas if you get into 1-3 territory or you lose all four, you know, you're opening up the door for Saskatchewan to jump you. You know, Panther City, I think we can kind of finally rule them out of playoff contention. But, you know, Calgary's still kind of knocking on the doorstep as well. You know, I don't think Calgary's going to be able to have enough to make a run here, but you know, they played this Warriors team tough and they have the talent. They're another team that, you know, at full strength, they can hang with some teams, but the injury bug has not been kind to them. You know, losing Curtis Dixon for a handful of games. And that's kind of where you see them break down. But yeah, I tend to agree. And, you know, a team we just mentioned in the Rush is another team that's kind of backs against the wall. They're really in must win territory now. And we are not sure if, you know, Derek Keenan, GM of the Rush, was going to make any moves in terms of selling, you know, before the deadline of March 12th. Instead, he ended up making a move for goaltender Eric Penny, who played five seasons with the Warriors, was a free agent, got picked up by the Wings this past season when, you know, Zach Higgins went down. He only played one game, played really, really well for them in that one game. So Rush trade for him, I think it's a good move. I think it's a better, you know, move for the Wings, who get the 23rd overall pick. So they move up a little bit, just trading their second rounder and Penny after signing him as a free agent. But I don't know if this really gives me any more confidence in the Rush. I don't think Schutt's been playing terrible. You know, I think if they had Eric Kirk, they would maybe steal a few more wins than they have been right now. But I still think there's a lot of issues with this team, you know, on offense as well. You know, the absence of Ben McIntosh. Unfortunately, Josh Currier hasn't been able to kind of fill that void, you know, and he was traded for Ben McIntosh. So that's where I don't know how I feel about this Rush team. Definitely an interesting trade, and I don't think it's a bad one. I just don't know if it's going to make a difference. I don't know. What are your thoughts on this Rush team?
I agree. I was kind of like scratching my head a little bit because I didn't really think of the Rush as like a defensive squad or a goaltending squad that was on the poor end mm-hmm. of the league. Just looking at it, you know, at face value, they've been pretty steady in letting up amount of goals. You know, they've been hovering in between 7 and 13, which is, you know, generally fine. Their goals averaged against is, you know, 10.75, which is probably right in the middle of the league. Mm-hmm. So I don't really see the problem being on that end. But on the other hand, their offense has clearly been struggling. In a lot of games, hovering around only 10 goals, where we've seen plenty of other teams be able to outscore, like even the Riptide, they're you know, scoring multiple more goals on average. So if the Rush want to come back into playoff contention, I don't think a goalie is going to solve that problem. They either need to, you know, somehow figure out a way to improve the team chemistry, or maybe implement some kind of new offensive system. What that might be, I don't know what that looks like. But they definitely need to generate more offensive production instead of bringing down the other teams per game. Mm-hmm. Because I don't think you're going to reliably be able to keep teams under 10, especially when we get to the playoffs against teams like the Bandits and the Seals and the Rock when they're healthy, like you were saying.
Yeah, and I think it, you know, goes back to the Rush used to have a lot of depth, and you know, they've lost some pieces. But you need Mark Matthews, you need Robert Church to come out and have big performances. You know, you need Ryan Keenan to have big performances. You know, Dan Lintner's been playing well too, but you know, I think you're not seeing the Rush put it all together. You know, you'll have one or two of these guys have big days, but then the other ones are quiet. And you know, those names I just listed, those are all great players, but you know, we're not seeing this type of success that you have seen with the Bandits, where like everyone's going, you know, I feel like it's an off day for somebody on this Rush team all the time. And that's where I think, you know, they're seeing some struggles. And again, you know, I don't think it's a goaltending issue necessarily, but Schutt definitely isn't one of those top tier goaltenders. So, you know, you're not getting elite goaltending day in, day and out. Again, I don't think he's the problem, and I still think they start him over Penny. I think Penny gives them an option in case Schutt's struggling. But yeah, this team, you know, they've hung tight with a lot of teams. They haven't been blown out really, other than that Firewolves loss. So, you know, that's kind of an anomaly at this point, but definitely cause for concern, and they definitely need to get a win very, very soon.
And they need to figure out a way to like push the issue on offense. Like when you watch the Bandits, you feel like everybody knows where everybody is on the floor. Like mm-hmm. they have systems where they're generating cutters who open up skip lanes and stuff like that. You know, more off ball picks. And then I was watching more of the recent Rush games, and I just wasn't seeing any of that. Mm-hmm. And I was seeing a lot of shots from the outside, which, you know, I don't think is the formula for winning a game in the NHL. Mm-hmm. So if they can push the issue and really get to the middle of the floor, I think they're going to have a much better time. but they just aren't, they just don't, something's off that it's not allowing them to have that same chemistry that we see on the Bandits and, mm-hmm. and other
teams. Yeah. And this is more an eye test thing, not me knowing, you know, but like, I feel like their percentage, they're not taking high percentage chances a lot of the time, which you see, you know, with teams that are struggling, it's the high percentage chances that, you know, the Bandits are always getting high percentage chances, you know, that they're a team that they really get to the middle of the field or the floor and make things happen, where, you know, you don't see that as much with the Rush, just from the games I've watched on them, you know. And again, this is an eye test thing more than, you know, me having numbers to crunch, but yeah, clearly they have some issues to solve. And I think they have enough veteran leadership that they can turn it around and still make a playoff run, you know, and potentially jump the Warriors team for a playoff spot. But right now they're definitely going to have to turn some things around. So those are our thoughts on this past weekend of NLL games. Now let's look forward to these matchups coming up. My matchup this weekend is the Firewolves with the Seals. It's the last one of the weekend. I think this is a good test for the Firewolves. Again, they've kind of been going through the gauntlet, and it's not getting any easier, you know, coming up. I think this is going to be a tough game for them, and I'm looking forward to seeing, you know, how Doug Jamison plays against this high-powered Steels offense. So that's my matchup to watch. What's your matchup to watch this weekend, Brian?
You know, eventually I'm going to come on one of these shows and shut up about Philadelphia, but my matchup of the week is going to be the Wings versus the Thunderbirds. They just played the Thunderbirds. The Wings just played the Thunderbirds and lost, and they're another team like the Firewolves that have been struggling recently. Particularly on offense, which is surprising given the potency of that offense. They got shut out in the second half to the Rock, and they didn't put up 10 against the Thunderbirds. And I don't remember the exact score of the previous matchup off the top of my head, but this also kind of like needs to be the beginning of a turning point for the Wings, because them, like a couple of other teams in the East, which, you know, like the Firewolves that you mentioned, and also the Swarm, all three of those teams are going through kind of the same gauntlet of teams where they're playing a lot of the top four, top five teams in the league in a row. So if the Wings really want to make a push for the playoffs, they have to either, you know, push through some of these top teams and also win against the teams that they're supposed to win against if they really want to make the playoffs. Because the Firewolves and the Swarm all have to go through the Thunderbirds, each other, and the Rock and the Bandits multiple times, which is like the strength of schedule is off the charts in comparison to what we were just talking about with the Warriors. Their tail end of the season is much like the beginning portion of the season, where strength of schedule is kind of in question. It might benefit them. The Wings are really going to have to fight their way to get themselves in the playoffs versus these other two teams. And this is the point in time where they have to do it, because they're more than halfway through their season.
Yeah. And that's the thing. The Wings don't have the advantage of kind of making up games because they played more games than a lot of other people. And the thing, you know, too, like we're talking about three teams for essentially two spots, potentially one spot. You know, it's going to be the top three teams from the West and then the top four from the East. And then that final spot is a wild card spot. It could still go to a West team. You know, I still think it's likely that we get three West teams and five East teams, but there's no guarantees. So you have the Firewolves, the Wings, and the Swarm. One of these teams isn't making the playoffs, and potentially two might not make the playoffs, depending on how things turn out. So I still think right now, the way things shake out, I think you get three West teams and five East teams, but you could still see four West teams and four East teams as well, which leaves you, if you like the Thunderbirds, Bandits, and Rock to take those top three spots, it leaves one spot for the Wings, Firewolves, and Swarm, you know, if the West does prove to get another spot. So it comes down to record for that final wild card spot. So yeah, definitely going to be interesting, something to watch going forward. But I agree with you. I think that's going to be a good game to watch as well. Looking forward to that rematch. But that's going to do it for us. Reminder, if you enjoyed this episode, make sure to subscribe and leave us a 5-star review on either Apple Podcasts or Spotify, wherever you listen. Huge thanks to Paul Cantabini for coming on the show. And even bigger thanks to you as listeners or viewers for tuning in to another episode of Pro Lacrosse Talk.